Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schloem. One of the most beautiful places on planet Earth is Yellowstone National Park. Its geyser basins and hot springs, wild rivers, and iconic wildlife like bison, grizzly bears, and wolves draw people from around the world. And often they like to take pictures of their adventures. But there's nobody that does that better than our guest, Tom Murphy. Tom is an award-winning photographer who's traveled around the world stalking wild mountain gorillas in Africa and trying to avoid getting eaten by polar bears in the frigid north. But his true spiritual home as a person and photographer is Yellowstone. His work has been featured on PBS specials on the park, and recently the United States Postal Service announced that one of Tom Murphy's bison photographs is going to be issued as a postage stamp. Tom grew up on a South Dakota ranch where he had to work helping his father in sub-freezing temperatures. Those experiences taught him how to live in the outdoors and how to survive extreme cold. That background has come in truly handy as he's become known for wandering into the backcountry of Yellowstone in the dead of winter, seeking out iconic shots of bison covered in frost standing near a thermal spring and the simple, majestic quiet of the park in winter. He joins us now to talk about his life and work. Tom Murphy, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thank you.
I'd like to start out by finding out about you growing up, because you grew up in a very special place that shaped your ability to function in the outdoors. Tell us about growing up on a cattle ranch in South Dakota.
Well, growing up on a cattle ranch in South Dakota, I didn't have any choice. That's where I ended up. But it was a good place to grow up. I liked to be outside, starting from a little tiny kid. And of course, it's on the prairie in South Dakota, and the climate's been compared to Siberia. So it's like 103 in the summertime, 40 below zero in the winter. And so I grew up horseback, on foot, in the back of a 51 Chevrolet pickup. But unlike most people, I enjoyed it. So I lived for the first about 20 years of my life, basically as my dad's hired man. He had about 400 head of cattle, beef cattle. So I learned a lot about wildlife behavior from watching cattle, being on horseback and having a pet dog and that sort of thing. And so it kind of prepared me in many ways for my life as a wildlife photographer. So I'm not afraid of being outside in any kind of weather, skiing across Yellowstone Park at 40 below zero, and hiking, sleeping in the dirt and the snow. I find it really interesting, challenging, and I wouldn't want to do anything else.
Yeah, I can imagine, well, I can't imagine, but, you know, being out there, having to go feed cattle when it's, you know, 30 below zero and the wind's blowing and, you know, your eyelashes are freezing shut and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And you've got to go get those cattle fed and watered and stuff. And you're out in that. Yeah, I would imagine that definitely taught you how to function in the cold.
Mm-hmm. Yes, right. Yeah. And whether I wanted to be there or not, you know, learning to work in the cold too, not just go out and ski or whatever, but a continuous process of solving problems, you know, taking care of cattle, like you said. And the landscape is prairie where I grew up, grassland, short grass prairie in western South Dakota. So I was the only real big challenge was climbing these mountains in the Rockies around Yellowstone Park. I didn't have to confront mountains in the past, but to be honest with you, it took me about 6 months to adjust to the altitude here. But other than that, I feel really comfortable. It's sort of like chasing cows, chasing bison or whatever.
Well, I'm very curious about how you got interested in photography. Were you interested in the arts at all as a kid? Or when did photography come into your life and how?
When I graduated from high school, I went to college to be a chemist. And because I liked the topic, but then I realized I didn't want to live in a chemistry lab. So I started to be a backpacker in the Black Hills in South Dakota and saw these beautiful things and decided to try to figure out how to tell people those stories. And I had no interest in photography before that or the arts at all. And went downtown and bought a camera, figured I'd try to take pictures. And I bought a Nikon because I figured if I didn't like it, I could sell it without losing too much money. So I'm completely self-taught. I ended up with a bachelor's degree in anthropology from Montana State University, but I have a degree, I say I have a PhD in Trash Can University in photography.
What do you mean by that?
A PhD, I'm self-taught. So.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, Trash Can University. I shot black and white film for about 7 years and threw a lot of it away. And black and white's a really good way, I think, to learn composition because you're not fooled by pretty colors. The composition has to be there. Blacks and whites and grays will die if you don't have, good composition. So it was a good training. So then when I moved to Montana and Yellowstone, then I started shooting color. And that was another learning process as well.
Well, I'm interested in your influences. Were you interested in other photographers when you were growing up? Because I have a background in photography. And when I was a kid, my heroes were Elliot Porter and Bill Ratcliffe and Ansel Adams, of course, people like that. Did you look at those kinds of photographers when you were first getting into this?
Well, not really. I paid attention to Ansel Adams because I shot black and white film and, kind of an inspiration of how to make landscape photographs. But there really wasn't anybody that I really noticed as a wildlife photographer. And so it was a matter of just stumbling around and trying to tell the stories that I saw. My assessment of photographers I really admire are people that use their photography or their art to make the world a better place. So my first person photographer I would list as an inspiration is W. Eugene Smith. Not a wildlife photographer, not a landscape photographer. He was I don't know how you describe it, photojournalism, I guess. And he wanted his work to make the world a better place. So it's kind of been my inspiration with my work is I try to tell the story, the stories of wildlife and landscape. And my idea is if I can illustrate these creatures and this landscape as beautiful, then people find them valuable. If they find them valuable, then they're more likely to work to protect them and save them. So it's kind of my big goal. I mean, I like to eat too, so I try to sell stuff. But my biggest goal is show people how wonderful this nature and wildlife, and particularly wilderness, it really is.
Yeah, and that's interesting because that was what drove Ansel Adams too, was he was very interested in having his photography do more than just be, pretty pictures. He wanted them to engage people and have them care about places and people and the people that he worked with, like Dorothy Lange and people like that were in that same kind of school. So that's very cool. We're going to get to Yellowstone because I know that's your special place in just a moment. But you've been around the world. Give us a sense of some of the places you've been and some of your favorite places.
Well, Yellowstone's still my favorite place, but Antarctica is spectacular. I've been there 10 times. And the ice scapes is what really kept drawing me back. So there's some spectacular places there. Difficult to get to, very expensive. So, that's not accessible to a lot of people. Africa, Central and East Africa is also beautiful. My favorite animal in the world is a mountain gorilla from Central Africa. And so I try to go back there if I can to see them. Alaska has some beautiful wild country, wild creatures. The Galapagos is beautiful. It's a little overrun for me at this point, to be honest with you, but some interesting wildlife to be seen there.
You mentioned the mountain gorillas, and you have some beautiful photographs that I think are just so special of a mother gorilla with a baby. And I'd like you to share with us what it was like for you to first encounter those gorilla families, because the male gorillas, the silverback, male gorillas, they definitely make their presence known. So tell us what it's like to be in the presence of those mountain gorillas.
To be in the presence of mountain gorillas is almost a spiritual experience for me. They're beautiful, they're big, they're huge. The big males weigh about 500 pounds, which is as big as Yellowstone grizzly bears. And their heads the males are a foot and a half across almost, and giant canine teeth, but they eat vegetation. So the first impression is they're huge and they're kind of scary. But if you spend time with them, their family bonds are powerful. One of my favorite photographs, if you noticed, is that mom holding about a six-week-old baby gorilla. And they were kissing each other, stroking each other's face. And there was this big silverback behind me running around, yelling and pounding his chest. I didn't even look at him because this was so spectacular. And if people treated each other as well as they did there, this world would be a better place. So I'm really happy that I had the privilege to sit there and witness this affection. And it comes out in this photograph really well, I think. And so I'm pretty proud of that particular picture. But the first time I saw them was in Zaire about 35 years ago, and they weren't very habituated. And I got charged a lot by the silverbacks, and it's pretty scary when the 500-pound gorilla runs at you, comes to within like 2 feet of you, yelling and throwing things. It took a lot of nerve actually to go back the next day. But I had a lot of wonderful experiences with these guys. Been there 14 times, which means you get 1 hour. You pay to go in to see these gorillas. As soon as you see them, they start the clock. You have 1 hour and you have to go home. So I've spent 14 hours with them is all. And I take students into these to see these gorillas. And somebody always starts to cry because they're so spectacular. It's hard to describe. I try to tell people in my photographs. One of the stories that I really enjoy is they are still concerned about snares. I mean, there's some gorillas that are missing fingers and hands when they got caught in snares as little bitty gorillas. They're not strong enough to break these snares apart. So they're afraid of snares. So there's people in Rwanda that guard these things all day long with guns. And the gorillas not only protect their little guys, if they see a snare, they chase all their babies away and they drag the people away too. They don't want the people to get caught in snares.
Oh, wow.
And so what happens is the guards, you know, they get drug away from these snares, and they have to wait till the gorillas get out of sight and sneak back and take the snare out.
Well, that's amazing. Okay, let's talk about your special place, Yellowstone National Park, which was one of my favorite places too.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about the first time you went to Yellowstone. Can you remember what that was like for you to be there for the very first time?
Not exactly. My parents, my dad was a workaholic. He took 1 3-day vacation a year. We drove all day to west to the Tetons, Yellowstone, whatever, and then recreated for one day and then went home. So I was here when I was a tiny little kid. My first memory of Yellowstone, though, was I was probably about 8. And again, I grew up on the prairie in South Dakota with almost no water. So he bought a ticket for a 2-hour boat ride on Yellowstone Lake, and I was absolutely spectacularly amazed. I'd never seen that much water in one place in my life. You know, I've now been on the ocean a bunch of times, but Yellowstone Lake is still kind of a special attraction to me. But the first trip that convinced me I wanted to live here was 1975. My wife and I, we just got married. We did a trip out west. We spent about 6 weeks traveling around in the west visiting parks. We lived in Rapid City, South Dakota at the time. So on our way home, she dropped me off at the north end of Yellowstone Lake, and I backpacked to Cook City. It's about 50 miles, took me about 5 days, and she went on home back to Rapid. So I had to get a backcountry permit at the time, and yes, you still do. And the ranger said, when I got my first permit laid out, she said, "You have the last backcountry campsite in Yellowstone Park. Yellowstone Park is in the backcountry is full." And I thought, oh God, who's going to bump into all kinds of people? So in that 5 days, I ran into one couple for 45 seconds, ran into a guy and his son on Cache Creek who were fishing. I talked to them for about 10 minutes, and that was all. And I said, if Yellowstone's full, I'm moving here with just 4 people in a week.
That goes a long ways towards, you know, how I feel about how you should experience a national park. And you mentioned mm-hmm. this a little bit earlier, but, you know, some people just experience it from the road. You know, there's you know, in their bumper to bumper existence of, oh, look over there, there's a bison just off the road. Mm-hmm. But the way to really experience a place like Yellowstone or any of the parks is to just get off the road and go off into the actual wilderness. Tell us about, you know, how important that is to you.
Profoundly important. There's about 450 miles of road in Yellowstone Park. If somebody else drives, you look out the window and you only see 8% of Yellowstone Park. So 92% is not visible from any road. And I'm, you know, I kind of in mixed feelings about that. And some people say, well, we need to get more people in the backcountry. Hmm. Well, I like it empty in the backcountry, to be honest with you. So my recommendation, though, is to, and even in the middle of summer, in the 1st of August, find a place, preferably early in the morning or late in the evening, park your car someplace, and just walk out of sight of the road. And the silence and even solitude that you will feel there at that, you know, relatively short distance, sit down and just sit and listen and look. And it will affect you in a positive way. And I'm sort of selfish. I do that all the time and never, ever get tired of it. Something's happening. It may not be dramatic. It may not be a National Geographic special kind of experience. But if you can get away from human sounds, your cell phone, the dings of your car, people doing things around you, you can get closer to yourself and you can get closer to what's really important, which is wilderness, which is where we came from. We evolved out of wilderness. And by going back and just sitting, trying to absorb the wilderness of Yellowstone, it's surprising. 5 million people visit there, but that 92% could be yours to go and truly learn to love that kind of place.
Yeah, I live, like you, very close to a national park, Lassen Volcanic National Park. And it's 45 minutes away from my door. And I do the same kind of thing where I'll go up there, park, and you only have to go a quarter of a mile at most. And you can just, like you said, sit down and immerse yourself. And just the amazing thing is the sounds of nature and the quiet is so good for your mind, you know, to just take you away from the world that we live in, which is far too noisy and busy.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I mean, I can't stress that enough. It's a matter of slowing down and relaxing. I mean, I spend a lot of time in the southeast corner of Yellowstone. It's a place called the Thoroughfare, and Yellowstone River runs into Yellowstone Lake along the edge of the Absaroka Range on the east side of the park. There's a backcountry patrol cabin there called a Thoroughfare cabin. It's the most isolated occupied building in the United States outside of Alaska. Ooh. It's in Yellowstone Park. It's crazy that that's exists. And by going into that place like that, you're going back in time in many ways, in a positive way. You know, it's full of wildlife and things are happening there that have nothing to do with us, which I really like. It's kind of like my attraction to doing wildlife photography. I have no control over the movement of the wildlife, have no control over the weather, and I like that a lot. It's on their terms. It's on nature's terms. And I'm just a witness and a willing witness as well. So I just encourage people to sort of embrace uncertainty, embrace the variety of wild country. It's wonderful.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us as we continue our conversation with nature and wildlife photographer Tom Murphy. Tom is most well known for his incredible photographs in and around Yellowstone National Park. I'm Dave Shlohm, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening to Blue Dot. If you're just joining us, our guest is wildlife photographer Tom Murphy. He's photographed wildlife and nature around the world, but Tom is most well known for his iconic photographs of the wildlife and landscapes of Yellowstone National Park. Let's talk about some of your amazing encounters and stories with wildlife. One of my favorites is grizzly bears are something you find in Yellowstone Park, and not something that I would want to get close to. They are magnificent animals. But you have an incredible story with the attorney Bob Bennett, I believe. Tell us about that.
Very memorable experience. I've probably had upwards of 1,000 encounters with grizzly bears from Alaska all the way down into the Tetons. And I've been charged 3 times. And each one of them is really memorable. 2 of them happened pretty quickly. It was August, about 25 years ago, I guess. Bob Bennett, at that time, had a house in Livingston, Montana. Met him at a party, and he said, "Yellowstone is just a bunch of Winnebago bumpers." And I said, "Well, you need to get off the road." So we arranged a hiking trip, and we left the highway in the northern part of Hayden Valley, went past Sulphur Mountain, went hiked west. And, of course, it's during the bison rut, and so basically, I love bison. So we're looking for bison. We'd been back about 2.5 miles or so, and we walked over this little ridge, and there was a dead bison about 50 yards away. And you never go to a carcass in bear country, you know, unless there's 47 of you. So we stopped. You know, Bob was from Brooklyn and didn't know how to use binoculars. So he's kind of gawking around trying to find this thing in the binoculars. And we're not going to walk up there, but he got a good look at it with his binoculars. And I speculate it probably was killed by another bison bull during the rut. So we talked a little bit, turned to the right, started walking slightly diagonally away from this carcass, made it about 7 steps, and a grizzly head pops up in the belly of this bison. And fortunately, she was looking into the belly of the bison, and she didn't see us. And I said, "Bob, we got to get out of here." And he gets his binoculars out and said, "No, we got to get out of here." So I got him turned around, walking straight away from her now. And I was heading for a herd of bison. I'm not afraid of bison. I was going to walk into that herd of bison, use them as a shield. And we were starting away, maybe another 20, 30 yards. And he turned around with his binoculars again. So I grabbed him and turned him around. We got 110 yards away. I walked this off later. And she saw us. And she freaked out. She starts running around in circles, throwing dirt on this carcass, trying to protect her food. So I got down. Bob did what I did and looked small and not threatening. That was what I was thinking. And then when she was running around, she woke up triplets. So the most dangerous time to be near a bear is when she has babies. Second most dangerous time is when she has a carcass. So it was kind of
you had them both. You had the grand slam there.
Yeah, right. And we were close, 110 yards. So while we're waiting to see what was going to happen, she's running around. She's standing on the carcass, puffing and popping her jaws and swaying. And she was really agitated. I was thinking, well, I took a couple of photographs. And then she drops down on all fours, comes running at us full blast, the 3 little cubs running after, trying to keep up. And so I stand up now and try to look big and thinking, this is going to hurt.
Oh, boy.
So here she comes. I figured about 50 yards, I'd put my arms in the air, look as tall as I could, yell whatever I came to mind. And at about 20 yards, if she's still running, I'd drop on ground, cover up the back of my neck, curl up, and hope she chewed on Bob instead of me. And at about 60 yards, she turned around, ran back over her cubs, back past the carcass, and left. And fortunately, Bob stayed with me. So I think we looked like one thing that didn't run away. She decided, well, I guess we must be tougher than her. So we went on, had lunch a little bit later. And of course, Bob is from Brooklyn. He'd never had anything like this happen to him before. So he said, "What would you have done if I hadn't been there?" And I said, "I'd have gotten a lot further away," because he was dinking around with his binoculars. "I would have gotten into that herd of bison, I think." So he said, "You mean I almost got us killed?" And I said, "Yeah, you did, actually." So he bought a print of this, one of the photographs I made of this grizzly standing on her hind legs on this carcass with the 3 little cubs beside it. And he put it in his office in D.C. And he said he put a plaque on the bottom of the frame. It says, "I stared down this grizzly bear, so I'm not afraid of you." So, which is pretty true. He didn't run.
And he was Bill Clinton's attorney, right?
Yeah, he was Bill Clinton's attorney. So he bought a print from me and gave it to Bill Clinton. And he said when Clinton looked at this photograph, he looked at this grizzly bear and he said, "That's what the press looks like to me."
Yeah, that's an amazing story. And you did mention that you weren't afraid of walking into a herd of bison. I want to give a caveat here that if you understand animals and you're a part of that world like you are, you mm-hmm. can do that and you can feel that way. But we see so many cases now of people who are what I call indoor people, not outdoor people, that go out and, you know, encounter and interact with bison in inappropriate ways. Could you just maybe comment on your thoughts about that?
Yeah, that's a good warning to people. It's like, it's not a good idea to walk into a herd of bison, but again, they're a lot like cattle. And I spent 20 years of my life sure. around cattle. Yeah. So, you know, I read the herd of bison, you know, if there's an aggressive bull there, I wouldn't walk towards him. You know, wildlife, without exception, does not want you around. So that's the thing. So most of the time they run away if they don't want you around. And sometimes they don't want you around, like the grizzly bear, they'll run at you and try to knock you down. So you got to read what I call body language. Some people think that animals can read our minds. No, they don't read our minds. They read our body language. And so I learn as much as I can what their body language is saying. So I can sit on a hill, and I do sit on a hillside watching whatever animal, and I'm actually working. I'm watching how they interact with each other, how they interact with the landscape, the weather, how they move, what they do when there's some sort of a threat, large or small, what's their response. And, you know, I'm constantly learning about this. And it's not a good idea to go approach any animal, whether it's a field mouse or a gorilla or a bison or a whatever, unless you have some idea what their life is like and how they would respond to a stranger, a threat potentially, like me, approaching them.
Yeah, and I get a sense from you and what I know about you that your philosophy about your photography is that you're not going to take a photograph that's going to in any way make the animal feel uncomfortable. You know, you want that interaction. If you're going to just be able to observe an animal, you're going to just do that. And if you can get a photograph without bothering them, then great. Is that kind of the way you feel about it?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, when I look at it, I'm a guest in their living room, so I need to behave myself. It's mm-hmm. like, how would I respond if a stranger came into my house and like, what are they doing here? You know, so I'm a guest in their living room and I need to behave myself and respect their space. They're not there for my photographs. Absolutely not. That's not their job. They're not posing for me ever. They're just, I want them to go about their lives. And so I use big lenses because I don't want them to interact with me. I want their story of their lives, not what they think of me. And it's a matter of respect and humility and watching, A, that they're not threatened, not nervous, not interacting with me, you know, responding to me. And then I'm privileged when they calm down and just go about their lives and let me be there.
Well, grizzly bear encounters are definitely very exciting and memorable. One of the things that most impresses me about you is your adventures in winter in Yellowstone, because you've traversed across the park on cross-country skis. When was the first time you did that?
Got a map here in my office here I'm looking at right now. I probably got about, like I said, about 2,000 miles.
Wow.
That's overnight trips, not day trips, mm-hmm. sleeping in the snowbanks. So 1981 was my first time I went east to west. I went most of the way from the Pahaska Teepee, the east entrance, across towards West Yellowstone. And I basically got bored, and the last 3 miles or 3 days was just going to be heavy timber. So I just went home. But the first time I went all the way across the park was 1985. And in 84, I graduated college in 84, so I hadn't had time in the winters before to do a major trip because I was still going to school. So 85 had a free winter. So I had six people who agreed to go with me, and they steadily found reasons not to go. One guy broke his arm. I think it was on purpose.
Jumped out of a tree. I'd rather go to the hospital than cross the park with him.
That's right. I can't admit I'm scared. So the last guy bailed out 30 minutes before we were supposed to leave town.
Oh, wow.
And we packed up our backpacks the night before, and he called me and said his dog was sick. And I don't know what he fed his dog, but he chickened out, which was fine because he quit before we were back in there 4 days and, you know, a difficult spot. So I had the time, I was in condition, and I'd been out a lot of time outside on my own already.
So by yourself, you did this solo?
Did solo, the whole thing, yeah. So my wife and I went down to Jackson, stayed overnight in Jackson. She dropped me off on the end of the plowed road about 3 miles south of the south entrance of the park. And at about 70-pound pack, skied into the south entrance to get a backcountry permit. You need it in the wintertime as well as the summer. So I had my route in my head. I don't own a compass and I don't carry a map, but I knew the country pretty well. So it took me 14 days, about 175 miles, and I broke trail the whole way. Slept in the snowbanks in a little blue tarp because it was lighter than carrying a tent. And I had a little thermometer that put on my jacket pull, and it was pretty accurate. It was between 25 and 35 below zero every night. The daytime temperatures was about 5 to 15 above, which is a perfect temperature to ski carrying a big, heavy pack. I was usually just skiing in a T-shirt, actually. As soon as I stopped, I put on a big, heavy down jacket. So I started out and got a backcountry permit and left the road and headed east along the south boundary of the park. The first obstacle, which I knew about, was the Snake River. And there's also, I knew that there was no ice on the river because there's some hot springs upstream and there's no bridge. And so I brought a pair of wool socks for this crossing, this specific crossing. So I ski up to the edge of the river and it's 5 degrees and take off my clothes. I'm naked from the waist down. Tie everything on my pack, my skis, leave the waist belt unbuckled in case I fell down. I can't swim, but I wanted to get rid of that pack if I fell in the river. And use the ski poles to help balance me, and wobbled across and put these wool socks on, not for warmth, but for traction on these slippery round rocks on the bottom of the river. So it was about knee deep, got to the other side, pitched the pack into the snowbank on the other side, and took off these wool socks, laid them on the snowbank, and they froze within a couple of minutes, and put on my warm, dry clothes and shoes and socks and the skis and packed everything up, took off. And of course, I'm cold. My legs are numb. And I made it about 35 yards, and then I found out I was on an island.
Oh, no.
I hate it when that happens. Because now the main river was still ahead of me. And so now I had to ski to the shoreline again, took off my clothes. I had to dip the socks in the river because they were frozen. I had to loosen them up so I could put them back on again. And then the second crossing, the same problem, left the waist belt unbuckled, used the ski poles to help balance. And it hurts like crazy in these round rocks. You jam your toes into the next rocks. But, you know, my feet were numb about halfway across anyway, I guess. And it was about waist deep, just about ready to float. And so that was my first morning. And a lot of people have heard that story and say, I would have turned around and gone back. Well, if I had turned around and had gone back, I'd have to wade the river two more times to get out of there. So I was kind of committed. So I skied, again, breaking trail, usually about knee-deep powder. It snowed 12 of the 14 days. And my visibility was pretty poor. I generally could see maybe a quarter of a mile or just a couple hundred yards at a time. But it was still a really interesting experience. And to be real honest with you, I'm glad the guy didn't go with me because my connection to this land in the wintertime, I always had a strong connection. But one of the things that really affected me was it was in about 4 days near Harebell Creek on the south boundary, near the base of a place called Big Game Ridge, which is a miserable climb, steep climb. And I'm standing on about 10 feet of snow. There's no place to sit. Stop for a snack. It's a good excuse to eat chocolate and nuts. And all of a sudden I heard this thumping sound and I look around. What is that? I listen again. It was my heart. It was so quiet. My head had cleared out. And I've done a lot of trips since, and I always other people around or other noises, and I never had that long of a time with no other sound except my own. And it was really amazing. You know, I've sort of felt with that my heartbeat and the sound of the tapping branches in the wind, the sound of the streams when I had open water, I felt more a part of it because of that. You know, this rhythm of my heart and the rhythm of the land was kind of joined together there. It was, again, I'm grateful that it was, had the opportunity to be in the backcountry in true silent place for 10 days. I never didn't hit the road till 9.5 days later.
And there's something so very special about the silence of a snowscape, you know, in a place like that. And I know you also had kind of a spiritual experience following a mountain lion. Just tell us a little bit about that experience.
Yeah, that was the first clear day I had. It snowed all night up on top of Big Game Ridge a couple of days after I started hearing my heart. Again, in a sleeping bag, I heard it all the time. And I wake up pretty excited. Now I have some light. I can see around. It's not snowing. And about 100 yards from my head on top of Big Game Ridge were a set of brand new mountain lion tracks. Again, they were brand new because it snowed all night. She probably had gone by less than half an hour before I got daylight. And never did see her. What was really cool is following the entire day, she was kind of going the same route I was across to the east on the top of Big Game Ridge. And it was really cool that a mountain lion and I were the only ones up there. I mean, there's so much cold, heavy snow that most of the wildlife leaves. And even though I never saw her, I felt a pretty special connection to her.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us as we continue our conversation with wildlife and nature photographer Tom Murphy. I'm Dave Schlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening to Blue Dot. Let's return now to our conversation with Tom Murphy. Murphy has photographed wildlife around the world and is especially known for his work centered around Yellowstone National Park. One of his beautiful bison photographs was recently chosen by the United States Postal Service for a special commemorative postage stamp. Okay, let's talk a bit about your photography. Let's focus on that. It's just amazing to me to look at your work and think about, you as you said, you're self-taught, but you learn so much by just doing it constantly. You evolve as a photographer. I have a friend, Val Atkinson, who's a great photographer of fly fishing around the world and natural places. And he has kind of a very simple philosophy of what he calls LCM. Lighting, composition, moment. You know, those are the things that he focuses on trying to find to make a great photograph, and he really does. What are some of the principles that you've learned over the years that make for great photography?
I've been teaching photography for 40 years, and you can teach the technical stuff fairly easily, how to run that tool. But teaching people where to stand is really difficult. To a certain extent, I think that's, it can help people, but you have to have a sense of, A, what you like, what you want, what interests you, and learn your subject. My analogy is, unless you know the rules of baseball, you're not going to get good photographs of a baseball game. Otherwise, has no idea what they're doing. What, you know, why are they running around out there? And it applies to wildlife and landscape things as well. You have to be willing to be there in all weather, all seasons, all light, and learn your subject. So that's kind of the first thing. And then in terms of, we're trying to reproduce a three-dimensional world into two dimensions, a flat surface, your print or your computer screen or whatever. And so there's compositional recommendations, you know, placing stuff left to right, high, top to bottom, and keep people involved with the photograph. I classify a successful photograph as one that people will look at for 5 seconds or longer.
They'll engage with it.
Engage with it. Walk around, mentally walk around in that shot. And 5 seconds is a long time. 1 second is pretty typical. So the compositional things is how do you get people to look at it to begin with, and then how do you keep them there? So there's a couple of things. One of the things I call movement. It's a still photograph, but it's how the eye moves through the composition. And when one, you know, we always talk about in composition, everybody talks about left to right, top to bottom. Almost nobody talks about the third dimension, depth. How do you create the illusion of depth in a two-dimensional piece? And so my terms, nobody's written this down. I haven't either. Five tools that I always look for, no particular order of importance. Again, creating this illusion of feeling of depth in three dimensions. One of them is a curved line that's used a lot, you know, a stream, a road, or whatever, a line of trees. As it curves away, it feels like you're moving into that shot, into that composition. Another one is what I call color change, color or texture change. If you have two different kinds of colors, or transition, you know, light, shadow, whatever, you create a feeling of two different objects on different planes. Another one is relative size. You know, you've got a herd of bison in your composition. You've got some of them that are a certain size, and then they're smaller and smaller. Then the ones that are smaller feels further away. Another one is that you have to find all of these, and that is what I call atmospheric haze, whether it's a snowstorm, it could be fog, smog, dust, or whatever. Things get hazier because of that atmospheric haze. They look further or separate, at least, from stuff that's sharper. So you've kind of looked for those four things. And then the fifth one you can create to a certain extent with a phenomenon called depth of field. And that's large apertures. You get a shallow depth of field. So it's the background's out of focus, foreground's in focus, or foreground's out of focus, whatever. So you get a separation. It's sort of like atmospheric haze, except you create it with optics.
Those are excellent tips. And, you know, when I look at a great photograph, you know, those are the things that I look for. It's amazing to me. Like, I think of something like when I was learning photography, the rule of thirds was something we were taught. And I know, you know, that's, you know, a guideline, but it's not everything. One of my favorite stories is from John Ford, the great director, and it's shared in Steven Spielberg's movie, The Fablemans, where he, you know, young Steven Spielberg gets in to talk to John Ford. And he's talking about the sky, and he's not going to give him any tips or anything. And he's leaving. He said, "Get out of here, kid. I don't have time for you." But then he tells him one thing. He says, "Well, let me tell you about the sky. If it's really interesting, show a lot of sky. If it's not, don't." And it's like, okay. but when you look at a John Ford film, you will see that. You'll see like these magnificent skyscapes with clouds and everything, and a place mm-hmm. like Monument mm-hmm. Valley. But sometimes you'll just see a sliver of sky because the sky's mm-hmm. not that interesting.
Mm-hmm. That's good. That's good advice. Absolutely, yeah. If it doesn't add to the composition, it's actually a distraction.
And how about some wildlife tips? Like, you know, one of the things that I learned at your park at Yellowstone back in the day, I was with Perry Conway and Bill Ratcliffe there doing a photography workshop. And I was trying to get close to some bighorn sheep without disturbing them. And Perry said, "Do you know the lost wallet technique?" And I'm like, "The what?" And he said, If you ever noticed a coyote, they don't go directly at, you know, the animal that they're stalking. They just kind of walk back and forth looking at the ground. He said, they kind of look like they're looking for their wallet that they've lost. So the other animals, the animals that are the prey, they just think you're off busy doing something else. Do you have any tips for like things that you do to try to, you know, get yourself in the best position to photograph, you know, wildlife?
Mostly recommend just understanding what you're looking at, and what their behavior is, how they respond to you. And I mean, the lost wallet technique is interesting, but you still want to watch what their response is. You know, maybe, it might, you just being there could be a threat alone. I mean, generally, I would agree that walking directly towards something is a threatening thing to do. It's better to go diagonally, or even make a circle, that, you know, a loop around the animal. You know, of course, keeping in mind how the light is, what side of the animal you want to be relative to light, what the background's going to look like. So the best advice, I think, is learn what you're looking at. You know, what kind of things do they do? What's their body language? Because that's what I'm reading as well. And I classify wildlife in three levels. First one is, this is a coyote. They're beautiful. You know, everybody wants a headshot, and that they're cool. And the second level of interest and quality is that coyote is doing something, some sort of behavior, normal behavior, not alarm at me. And then the third, which is the most interesting and the hardest to get, is a coyote doing something in a beautiful landscape. So if you cover up the coyote, it's still a nice photograph. And those are the hardest to get because, again, like I said before, I'd like it that I can't control any of this stuff out there. And so to try to put those three things together in the same shot is a really wonderful challenge. And I constantly want to do it for the rest of my life. And so it's a matter of making a story that's relevant to the animal, or a group of animals, the creatures, that, you know, what do they do? Where are they? So it's not what are they, but who are they?
That reminds me of your beautiful photograph of the mother gorilla with her baby.
Mm-hmm. Right. Who are they? What are they doing out there? It's not just an illustration of a gorilla. There's this affection that I was able to witness and transmit with this photograph. You're the first, as a photographer, you're the first critic. And the truth is, when I saw that in the viewfinder, like I said, I ignored this gorilla behind me, this big male racing around, because I could see that this was a successful experience.
Well, you've taken so many photographs over your career and so many magnificent ones, special photographs. I won't ask you the inane question, what's your favorite one? Because it's just, that's kind of, you know, who's your favorite child question. Right. But for, right, you know, people who are your fans, who love your work, you know, are there some that they particularly gravitate towards?
Yeah, there's one that's kind of interesting. I made this photograph about 35 years ago. I published it in a couple of my books and did it in slideshows. It's a vertical photograph of a frost-covered cow bison with a blue cast, really strong blue cast. And I don't know how it happened, but somebody on Facebook, I don't pay attention to social media much, even though I do have a Facebook and an Instagram page. I hire somebody else to deal with it. They told me that some guy from Belarus claimed it was his photograph of a yak. A yak looks a little like a bison, but anyway, I can't run everybody down who's stealing my stuff. But that photograph has gone viral. I mean, there's millions and millions of likes for that photograph. And the problem with me is that most of the time my name is not on it, or somebody puts their own name on it and claims it's theirs. So that would be probably the most successful photograph, just because a lot of people have seen it.
The frost-covered bison photographs, they really like those. Well, speaking of bison, you have a postage stamp. And that is just the most amazing, wonderful thing.
I mean, that's kind of a crazy story because I, you know, out of the blue, an email from the post office wanted a picture of bison. Oh, I love bison. And so I sent them the blue bison, which I love, and a couple of others, my favorite. Turns out what they wanted was a shot of a broadside, more of a graphic broadside view of a bison. And they immediately fell, you know, in love with this one, the young bull, his head up in the air, kind of looking around. And it fit their graphic idea. But it surprises me still that that's turned into a huge phenomenon. People, one of my friends said they don't know anybody who has a photograph on a stamp that's still alive. It's like, well, okay, I guess I survived that.
Well, Tom Murphy, I just want to thank you for sharing your love of nature and wildlife, the natural world through the lens of your cameras. It's just magnificent work, and it's so special. And I just want to thank you for joining us to talk about your adventures in Yellowstone and beyond.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for listening to my stories. Thank you.
Thanks again to our guest, nature photographer extraordinaire Tom Murphy. You can check out his amazing work and learn more about Yellowstone National Park at his website, tmurphywild.com. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio, a service of Chico State Enterprises and licensed to California State University, Chico, in beautiful and talented Northern California. We're distributed by PRX. If you want to revisit, share, or check out past episodes, you can do just that on our website, mynspr.org. And while you're at it, subscribe to our podcast so you never miss an episode on our website, the NPR One app, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music, Big Wave Dave, is by Matt Schultz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fidler. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.